you could be featured in cultural and community hubs across the Lower Mainland. To find out how you can be featured in Discorder Magazine, contact advertising@citr.ca. advertising@citr.ca. Rates start at $150. Ride with Discorder Magazine and we'll take you all the way.
Being anti-capitalist is recognizing that, like, that I am complicit to, like, some extent, and in that recognition, trying to do whatever I can, be it in the smallest ways, to, like, try to sort of work against it.
That was Aliza Youssef, artist and organizer, and this is Medium Good. Welcome back to another episode of Medium Good. My name is Serena, I'm your host, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM. This is our third of four episodes in our limited series where we're talking about messages of resistance and the art mediums chosen to manifest them. Today we're going to be talking with Aliza Youssef from the Anarchist Collective, as well as Lee, also known as Rotting Wheeler, a tattoo artist from so-called Vancouver. I say so-called Vancouver because this was the name given to the land by colonization, not by the indigenous peoples that have lived here for millennia. The CITR station is on the campus of the University of British Columbia, which is unceded and stolen Musqueam territory. Indigenous voices in so-called Canada have been systematically devalued and diminished, and this cannot go unacknowledged in broadcast media such as radio. When I say voices, I don't just mean actual voices, I mean stories and knowledge and history that have been suppressed by colonization. In this episode, we're going to talk a lot about storytelling, and I want to just take a moment to acknowledge that a crucial part of Indigenous cultures and histories has been violently quieted. Palestinian voices during this continued genocide are also being silenced. But storytelling and art finds a way. I'll let Aliza from Anarchists explain this a little bit more.
My name is Aliza Youssef. My pronouns are she, they, and I run the Anarchist Collective with a bunch of other lovely folks. We're a completely like a DIY project. You know, we started as a couch surfing initiative, just a couple of friends getting together, trying to find a way to like just process, you know, the difficult emotions that comes with, you know, witnessing something so horrific as like the genocide in Palestine. And yeah, we started there just with the intention of just gathering and trying to navigate through action and processing it all through like also art. And yeah, in a couple months' time, we've grown into a beautiful collective with like volunteers who show up without any, you know, with no other reason but to just like, you know, like they show up with this like, you know, this desire to just essentially actualize their like dreams of like a free Palestine and of like collective liberation. And yeah, it's funny when people ask me that question. I don't even know how it started. It just kind of started and people just show up now.
Would you be willing to elaborate a little bit on what collective liberation means to you, or what it means in the capacity of this project?
Right. Collective liberation, I guess, like, it's very interesting because I think one of the biggest questions that we had to sort of confront was like, what does this issue have to do with me? And for those of us like in the earlier days, like when we were gathering, I think the organizers that were organizing with me we're all like people of color who have been like radicalized at a young age. We're like international students, and we know essentially we've been like following the movement for time. When this started, we were kind of also just trying to see how we could like facilitate like understanding. We're not Palestinians, but we can sort of we've understood the struggle, and we can see how it's all interconnected. So like it was so interesting because I think I've also kind of through this project as well realized how interconnected all of the issues around the world are. And collective liberation to me is like seeing like a free Palestine, and in a like in the process, like we'll see like so many of the structures that kind of allow this genocide to happen are also responsible, are also like the reasons why like there's Canada is like stolen land and stuff like that. This is essentially like what we're witnessing is like colonialism in like the present day. And I think a lot of people, there's like a cognitive dissonance like when it comes to like Palestine for some reason, because a lot of people empathize with like land back here but don't understand like the same exact thing is happening in Palestine. Collective liberation is land back. It's also free Palestine. It's also like free Congo and like and all of these kind of issues that are arising right now. The source is all the same.
Obviously, it's been said time and time again, but to me, it always just comes back to that late stage capitalism question about how, maybe at some point in the past, things weren't functioning with the same inertia that they are now. It's obviously, and it can't be stated enough, there is this class element of it, but it's also that we're at a point where the system functions on its own and it sustains itself, and we're just these little like cogs in the machine. So on that very political statement, can I ask you what being anti-capitalist means to you, and what it means in the capacity of anarchists as well?
I think community care is like one of the biggest things. Like coming together in communion is like it's hard for me not to like be cynical when it comes to like things like this, and we live in a very capitalist world, and everything all like even what's going on in Palestine like is like it's a beautiful land full of like riches and like resources that people want to like people want their hands on, the West wants their hands on. And which is why it's like it's never been like a religious issue. Realistically, like when I think about things like this, I feel like there's not much that I alone can do. But like when a lot of people gather and we have like the same vision, there is it's gonna be like a really slow change, but like we can work towards something that is, I guess, like a realistic goal. And that's kind of what we tried to do with the collective. It's like we recognize like in the beginning as well, like I remember like I didn't know what taking action looked like at all. It's interesting because I've learned so much just through like other people who are more well-versed in action. And like when we gather and like we like with like-minded folks and like we talk through our emotions and like how we're feeling, the complex like ways that we're feeling, we recognize that there is power in numbers. And it's funny because like we do this thing like every sort of like art build, we kind of alternate like between taking action and like doing something artistic to sort of kind of like I guess like balance the heaviness of taking action. Sometimes I like we think we're like, are these postcards even being received? But it doesn't really like matter. You know what I mean? It's just like it's the fact that we get together and we try, and like somewhere along the way, like maybe someone will hear us, you know?
Yeah, totally. Something I've been thinking on a lot recently is like, obviously, there's a value to organizing into community action that is directly tangible to the cause that you're organizing for. But I also think that such a huge element of it is just to create like a space for people to come together and feel like they're doing something, because it's that helplessness that really is the like emotionally defeating element, I think, of living in the system, where you feel like all these things are happening and you can be as educated as you want, but like you really have no power. So Yeah, that's definitely something I've been thinking about a lot is that community action, yes, it's for the cause, but it's also for us and for you just as much.
One of the biggest things that we realized was like, okay, we actually do have like power, you know? Because it's like if you can just like have a conversation with like three people and sort of like kind of have an impact on them, then they can have it with their, you know, circles. And it's like we have a lot more power than we give ourselves credit for. And like something that also like I feel like helped us realize that is like just like the power of social media. Like I've been following this movement since I was like 13. Like my dad used to talk politics on the dinner table, so like I knew like what had been happening. And since like I've never seen in all these years like as much momentum in the movement as there is right now. And it's because like I think people are recognizing they can do something. And it's such a shame because like I think like you see like children in like Gaza that have like be, like you know taken the responsibility of like showing us what's going on. They're becoming like journalists because you know it doesn't matter like journalists get like they're like everyone's getting killed. It doesn't matter like you know who you are. Israel doesn't really abide by like international law and like humanitarian law of just like not killing journalists. Like that's something that you can't do, but they just do that anyways. So you have like normal citizens, everyday citizens, like people like you and me taking, you know, becoming journalists. And one thing we really have to fight is like becoming desensitized, because I think that's what like the people in power want, right? Because like when you're desensitized, you kind of accept there's nothing that you can do to change it. Oh, like it always happens. Like, oh, there's always war in the Middle East. But it's like, you know, try our best not to ha have our hearts hardened. We have to like be open to like, you know, just wanting change. And
Where do you see the value of art, like adjacent to activism within that desensitization, kind of question?
yeah, like I love this question because it's like I feel like art is something that's so innate to like all of us. It's a tool that we've used since the beginning of time. It's like how we tell stories, how we navigate the world. And you can't trust newspapers because they're always going to be like biased and stuff like that. Art is something that I feel like still, I guess, like pierces through, especially like art made from like artists, Palestinian artists. When you sort of see that, it kind of like humanizes them as well. Because when you just keep like consuming these statistics of like, oh yeah, like 50 people died or something. And the way that like media, like Western media also like speaks of the death toll is like so crazy. It's like they're like, oh, these people just died. Not like they got killed or like deliberately like tar were like deliberately targeted. So when you see like the art, you see like, oh my gosh, like these people are humans too. These people are like just like you and me. They write songs, they sing songs, they write poetry, they paint. And I do think art is something that like really helps us like connect with one another, which is why I think it's so important like in times like this when you're like doubting or you're confused about what stance to take, always like something I do is like I always look at the art that is made by the communities that are, you know, being affected because they show so much.
Palestine has a rich artistic history, including a particular attention to textile arts. Embroidery has been a key feature of traditional Palestinian costuming for centuries, and there are two main types of embroidery, one called tatriz, which is a cross-stitch embroidery, and tahiri, which is a couching stitch embroidery. This embroidery and weaving is highly, highly intricate. But what's interesting to me is that embroidery and weaving is often called a handicraft instead of an art. The clear separation of different mediums into arts and crafts as opposites carries more weight than we may give credit for. The Western art world has a huge focus on depiction, art that has a clear narrative, like painting, photography, or film. And that's not to say that people from these cultures don't engage in those mediums as well. One of my favorite Palestinian artists, Halima Aziz, uses graphic design to tell stories of her land. But lots of art that has historical origins or does not conform to the Western modernist standards of what art is in a gallery space is simply just not included into those gallery spaces and therefore doesn't have a chance to be seen as fine art by exclusionary art world standards. Artist, writer, educator, and activist Gregory Cholette explores the elitist and white supremacist art world in his book Delirium and Resistance, Activist Art and the Crisis of Capitalism. We spoke about him in the first episode, about his work, The Art of Activism and the Activism of Art. So if you haven't listened to that one yet, please do so. It'll be on the CITR website. Right off the bat, in the introduction of the book, Cholette says, quote, "For people directly involved in it, the art world is a familiar space or system or economy that stands apart from the so-called real world and yet is also increasingly entangled with the real world, which curiously appears less and less real itself of late." This introduction argues that the art world must be analyzed as a, quote, totality, whose features are simultaneously more exposed and less exceptional thanks to the broader crisis of deregulated capitalism and erosion of liberal democracy at the start of the 21st century. The book is a general history and critique of capitalism and the art world and how the end of modernism, or the end of the Cold War, re-established capitalist values into the art world. We'll get into this text a little bit more later in this episode, but for now, I want to tie it back to Palestinian art and Aliza's words with another quote from later on in the first chapter. He says, "The art world is better grasped as a system of reproduction, one that, no matter how granular in appearance, generates real-world effects on the way artists live and work. For one thing, there can be no such thing as activist art, political art, interventionist art, or socially engaged art without the adversarial presence of our art world. This does not mean activists or social movements do not produce cultural artifacts or aesthetic concepts that could be described as art. On the contrary, such works will never be displayed as art without first passing through a mandatory filter of disinterested detachment." When I hear this, I think of the treatment of Free Palestine graffiti versus something like Pablo Picasso's Guernica. Both are distinctly political and of their times, but it's the space in which it can be seen and the artist attached to it, whether anonymous or world-renowned, that determines the public opinion. And this opinion is the first piece in determining its price. Political art is only well-received by the art world when it is detached from its message of resistance.
Like, I'm no one to say that it's not art, but I've always personally believed that good art is like art that sheds some kind of truth, be it your own or like a universal truth. And in my opinion, I do feel like if I, in recently, like if I haven't seen like an artist post about Palestine, to me, that is a little bit strange, because I think part of an artist's job is to like recognize that we play like a very important role in like driving culture. You know, like we have the privilege of like influence. We have that power to be able to change people's minds. And if you're not using that power to reflect what is going on or help amplify like a cause that needs attention, then I feel like it's a missed opportunity, essentially, you know? I think I've seen artists make more change than actual politicians at times, you know? Because we, like, in a lot of ways, like, I feel like artists have nothing to lose, You know, there's no like the real ones. I feel like there's no like agenda, but to like actually just connect. And I think that's like artists, like I still think like, you know, artists, art in galleries, like sure they could be good, but if they're not like reflecting of like what's going on, then I think there is a certain like sort of heartlessness to it, which I can't like, and you can kind of tell, like I can't personally like resonate with. So we host a couple of like, so we stand like host like your standard art build where you come in and you just do some action, do some art. When we typically alternate between the two so that it never gets too overwhelming. And there's always also like opportunity to mingle and like connect with people who are on the same page, which is also like that bit is so important because I think activism work is like, I'm not gonna make it seem like it's easy. Like it does take like a lot of like emotional kind of, it can have that toll. But like when you're surrounded by people who like think the same and have the same like ideals and just like visions of like a better place, just want a better world, you actually get so motivated yourself. And it's like a beautiful energy exchange. And then there's always food, like people. Like, you know, we do like a potluck situation. So like it's bring whatever you can, but no one is obviously turned away for like, it's a very like open space. But then we also, so that's like your standard art build. But recently we've been also doing more like workshop based events where, you know, last event was like a zine making event that was hosted by Cassandra. She's amazing. She's like, you know, she also isn't the mastermind behind our link tree, which has all the actions, and we've all learned so much from her. And she was doing a little zine workshop, which people attended and loved. We've also obviously had our screen print party where we alternated between writing postcards and doing screen printing. Upcoming, we have a book club that we're going to introduce, run by two lovely volunteers, Atisha and Kushi. And that's going to be really fun. We're going to, I think we're reading like books on just like decolonizing. It's all content that will help you, you know, unlearn and relearn. Yeah. And it's such an open community, by the way, where like if you want to join the team, you can join the team. If you want to host events, you can do that. All you got to do is just let us know and just come through and. Yeah, you're part of the team. It's that easy. I just want to give us like a special shout out, obviously, to like Zandy, who is the who works at the JBG and who has really graciously housed the collective and has taught me so much and about like organizing, and also Cassandra, our action leader, who is always so on it and has taught myself and the team so much about taking action. And just everyone in the team that like in the ever-growing team that just, you know, continues to show up.
CITR's partner magazine, Discorder, also just published a profile on anarchists, so go check that out if you haven't already. I really love the work that Anarchist is doing. I think it's really awesome to have an art-making collective that is outside of those confines of definitions and labels that we were talking about a little bit earlier, something that is community-run, grassroots, and has a clear goal, which is community engagement. I think that a lot of the work produced by anarchists would fall under Gregory Cholette's definition of institutional critique. Quote, "Work that is less concerned with the formal aspects of art than with the unseen economic and social structures that buttress art's institutional setting." He continues in saying, "What has been revealed by the institutional critique is one persistent and disturbing fact. Many cultural institutions are led by the private interests and personal tastes of an invisible elite, rather than by their stated philanthropic and educational mission. Indeed, if there is the possibility of leveraging the all-too-conspicuous benevolence of the art museum and of proceeding where institutional critique has left off, it is through work that extends off-site politics into the museum, then propels it back out into the public arena. Yet, this still raises another question. Just who and what is outside the museum, and how do these off-site, institutionally resistant spaces and practices perceive their relationship to the authority of the institution? All right, I know that that passage was a little bit technical, so thank you for hanging in there. But I think there are some really good pieces in that. What Cholette is essentially saying is that gallery spaces are controlled by an elite, and their tastes dictate what is permitted to be in that gallery space, which we would think would mean that no critique of the elite or of the gallery space would be allowed in, but that's simply not true. There is a certain amount of political art and critical art that is allowed into these gallery spaces. We know that because we see it, and that's what the rest of Cholette's book is about. The essence of what he's saying is that the gallery as an institution is an apparatus of capture, which is a concept from philosopher Gilles Deleuze, and what it captures is the enthusiasm and productivity of political and oppositional artists. What this means is that every political art movement will eventually be co-opted by the institution and put in that gallery space. We can see that even with our talk of the Vancouver Art Gallery's zine exhibition in episode 2 of this series. Such is the cycle of capitalism, as it takes the bits that are sellable and it takes out the rest that is oppositional. But we have spent a lot of time in this series talking about the institution and gallery spaces, and I want to break away from that a little bit and look at an art form that works completely outside of the institution. For this, we're going to talk to Lee, also known as Rotting Wheeler on Instagram, a multidisciplinary artist living in so-called Vancouver. The focus of this conversation is still about capitalism, because even though Lee, as a tattoo artist, does not need to be in a gallery space to be seen or be financially successful, they still feel the effects of capitalism, especially on their activist work. And it's this duality that I think is interesting in being an artist that is anti-capitalist, but also out of necessity having to commercialize their art, because that is the world that we live in. But anyways, enough of me, here's Lee.
Hi, my name is Lee. I sometimes go by Baby, so sometimes people know me as that. Lately, I introduce myself as Lee. My pronouns are they and them. And I guess I'm an artist in Vancouver, which is a weird thing to say, because I feel like artists will find any reason to discredit themselves as being an artist. But I think it's good to kind of come into it and say, yeah, I'm an artist. That's what I do. It's how I express myself. I also like to call myself a storyteller, because I just really like to tell stories. And that's not always verbal. I think maybe speaking verbally is my least favorite way to express myself. But that being said, I have my art. I have all these tools and all these different mediums to express a feeling or share a message, right? So, I think it's just a different way to communicate and to reach people. And it's a way to reach people in like a way that almost transcends space and time. Like, we can have this conversation, but then that's over. But then I could make a sticker that says Free Pally or something and put it on a lamppost, and that's kind of done for me. But I don't know who later on will see this in the future and how that will affect them, or like what kind of conversations it sparks. It's kind of out of my hands. So yeah, just having this like pathway to like create ripples. Being an artist is something I almost resisted for so long, even though it's been a part of me since I've existed. You know, I've always been drawing and I've always been doing some kind of art. But then just like having it be just a small part of my life, and that part of my life just be so precious. I've just kind of slowly let that take over. And it naturally, people have been asking me, for more tattoos. I hand poked in my drama class in high school, and now I'm a tattoo artist. It just feels very unreal, but it makes sense. It's just something that I got into and people respond to, and so continues naturally. So yeah, I think that's a lot of how I've even like making stickers. Like I made a small run of sticker sheets and everybody loves them, and I didn't realize how much people love my art. So that's another huge part of it, like having this community aspect that is so valuable and symbiotic. It's like I need it as much as other people need it. And like I said, it just makes sense. Definitely when I think about art and activism, I think about my friends Zion. Their Instagram is science fiction art. And my friend Gal at lucky.muny, MUNY. And those are both people who are very, very active in the community, and I just really respect. Like, for instance, Zion currently is in direct contact with someone named Mohammed and his family in Gaza, and is selling stickers, like really beautiful stickers for them. And so that, it's like, for me, is kind of just wraps up everything we just said, like gaining this attention for this beautiful piece of art, and then seeing like what you can do with it and how you can actually connect that with the environment currently, right? And so yeah, Zion is doing that. Please check out their profile if you can. And Gal also does lots of activism work, very involved with pro-Palestine stuff, but even more so is a really huge part of protecting Chinatown. And they have a very long family history of being involved in protecting Chinatown. And so you can check out their work as well.
I really like what Lee said a little bit earlier on about how using their words is one of their least favorite forms of self-expression. I honestly think that that's the same for me, and truth be told, I've been having a lot of trouble doing this project just because I think that this project has brought up so many things to think about and to feel, and things that I don't necessarily know how to express just with my words in this type of format. And I think one of my favorite modes of self-expression is honestly in the way that I look, in the way that, I do my hair or the clothes that I'm wearing, or getting tattoos, that type of thing. So I do think that that's probably why I was motivated to speak with someone like Lee, who I think shares these values. And in speaking about the way that you look as part of someone's self-expression, I want to take a little moment to talk about the history of patches in counterculture, because one of the things that drew me to Lee's work is their Dolph patches, which they're going to talk about in a couple minutes here. But first, I want to just give a quick little rundown of why patches are so important to a lot of countercultures. So for hundreds of years, patches weren't necessarily considered fashionable or even a part of fashion. It was just a way that people would patch up their clothing when it was worn through. Patches became seen as kind of a negative emblem of the working class or the working poor, because those were the people that weren't able to afford new clothes when their clothes went threadbare. And what's interesting is that even now, I have a lot of friends, and myself included, who like to patch up their clothes or like to sew things back together when they get a little bit broken. And I know that not everyone does it, but at least in my social circles, I think that that's becoming a lot more accepted and a lot more celebrated, is those ways of kind of reducing your consumption of clothing and fixing what you already have, or trying to make something cool out of something that could have otherwise been thrown out. But anyways, it was really in the 1960s that patches came to stand for something else as well. Vietnam War protesters that became known as the hippies used the way that they looked very intentionally. And because in protesting they were taking up a lot of physical space with marches or encampments, their appearance was basically a billboard for what they represented. This was also the time period where street photography was getting really big, so a lot of photos were coming out of these young people dressed in really sensationalizing ways. So patches with slogans on them had the double effect of being eco-friendly and fixing up people's clothes, which was especially helpful if they were sleeping outside at encampments or in vans or just generally living a nomadic lifestyle, and also projecting their values and their protest signs, essentially, on their actual physical person. In the 70s and 80s, the punks took this even further, and the symbols used to stitch onto the patches essentially did a 180 from peace signs to pentagrams. Now the patches were mostly being roughly stitched on or safety pinned to leather jackets, denim vests, that type of thing, so they were no longer necessarily serving the purpose of actually patching up your clothes, and they had fully become a fashion statement. And now patches are everywhere. You can buy them on Amazon for $10 for 50 embroidered patches, or in any stores. There was a total trend in 2016 of those green bomber jackets with patches stitched all over them. And just like we talked about with Gregory Cholette's work on the art institution, mainstream culture has inevitably co-opted elements of counterculture and depoliticize them. This is due to something that I've heard being called the pursuit of cool, which is the vicious cycle of a counterculture using something that has an aesthetic value, which ends up gaining popularity in its own right. So essentially, it makes complete sense to me that Lee brought up patches when I asked them about art and activism.
Well, for me, I find that art and activism are quite linked and often are one and the same, not always, but I find that for me, it's almost a no-brainer that I use my art to share messages of like what is happening currently in our situation, like around the world, in Palestine, in Sudan, but also like in our community, like for venues that are shutting down like 648 or fundraising for Delph, for Jeremy and Eris, who have been recently convicted for illegal quote unquote distribution of safe supply during our fentanyl crisis now. Yeah, I guess when I think that like people, or when I realize that people associate me with fundraising efforts, for me it kind of, I don't really have that click in, and for me it's just like, oh, this is a thing that's happening, and I just respond by expressing myself through art, and people identify with that or people connect with that, and that just becomes a space in which we can fundraise for these causes. So like I never think GoFundMe, you know, like I never think not that that's necessarily bad, but in my mind it's gathering people who feel the same as me, who can educate me and I can continue to educate, stuff like that. And so I'll make these really great big batches of machine stitch patches, and they'll say something along the lines of defund Israel or free Palestine, or I just started making this new one that says make Israel Palestine again. And these patches I'll just make and hand out for free, because it's not a huge loss on my part. You know, like I make money off other patches, and a lot of my materials are sourced, you know, from the thrift store and stuff. So for me, I don't even factor in the costs of what I'm losing. I just think of how can I get this message to as many people as possible. And it's not something that I want to take money from, you know, so yeah, that's something that I've been up to.
Yeah, I really like that idea of like, you don't see it as a cost to you because it's something that you'd be producing naturally anyways, like to you that it is art that you're making and art that you want to be making. So you might as well just be like putting it out and like building that community and like sharing the things that you're making with people that are also like aligned with the things that you're thinking.
Well, yeah, I mean, I feel like there are some people who hold the belief that like they would not be interested in seeing art made by a millionaire, you know, like made by someone who maybe would not experience something, some of the things that other artists who are marginalized for whatever reason would produce because they are a little bit closer to the issue, maybe. Or the idea that art that is apolitical is meaningless. And I don't know if I like am like fully gung-ho with that, but I think that does speak to art being a tool of resistance, and art being a really big means of communication for activism, for conversations that need to be had. And then sometimes I just think like what's the difference between like an IKEA painting or photo and like art that I can do, right? It's like there's some like soul to it. There is a little bit, you can feel a kind of narrative come through.
Can you really separate the art from the artist? Is expensive art just a way for billionaires to hide their wealth? These are important questions and questions that people ask quite frequently. I don't know if I can ever answer these questions fully for myself and definitely not give you a definitive answer, but I think that the conversation really needs to start and end with commercialization. Somehow, through mass production and corporatization, art has still been seen as a legitimate form of self-expression that people want to pay for. Art has this reputation in society as basically the best that humans can offer, the very best of society and the world that we've created. But inflated prices of fine art gives the impression that only the ultra-wealthy is deserving of the best society can offer us. Of course, not every painting is worth $5 million, and not every art piece is even trying to fit into the category of fine art. And of course, there's the argument of art galleries being open to the public. But I disagree with that as being a sign of the accessibility and the democracy of the art world. Big galleries often have pieces on loan from private collections, and even a gallery as big as Tate Britain only has an acquisition budget of £5 million per year. So sure, art isn't accessible and it isn't democratic when we're speaking about the art world. But does that really mean that commercialism is destroying art? I think that that answer lies in what we're looking for from art. And in a way, the art world being so exclusive to the ultra wealthy just makes the rest of us have to stick together that much more. So make art for art's sake and sell it or don't. Support your friends, whether they're commercializing their art or not, and listen to what Lee has to say next.
If I'm doing a fundraising effort, but like somebody can only show up this much, like that's so okay. And like then I see somebody, I'm never gonna like look at somebody and be like, oh, they look this way and that way, and so I'm gonna charge them more. But sometimes I'll see an identity that I feel connected to, and I want to give them things for cheaper or free or whatever. I just like hate the idea of money, but obviously I exist in a capitalist society and I can critique it as much as I want, but I do art for a living and I need to charge people money for my art. And I just saw this meme that my roommate posted because they're also a tattoo artist. It's like giggling and having fun with my tattoo client and then doing the most evil thing, like in charging them for the session. And it's like, yes, that feels evil to me, even though it's not at all, because we know the value money has. We know how much we are working for this money. We know how what it is to struggle in Vancouver. So it's not something that like we like obviously we want to make money off our art. That makes us happy. But like we never want to take more than we need to take. Not speaking for all artists, but a lot of artists feel this way. And so, yeah, like I like to say that I'm anti-capitalist all the time, I charge literally whatever for my art. Like if somebody has like a dollar and I've put up my patches for five, like whatever. I'd rather you have my patch than me have $4 that you might not have had. So yeah, I have this like always this tension, always this like thing I have to play out in my head, like how much do I deserve, and not underplaying that, and how much can I give back to the community? Like how much can I afford to be accessible? And if I could mention this fundraiser I did for 648, it was a tattoo fundraiser with a bunch of cool artists where we donated 50% of our proceeds to the venue, and we kept 50% of the proceeds. And even that made me feel a little like, oh, is that like a lot? Or like people gonna think like that's like I should be giving 100%, you know, like I have a lot of things going on in my mind, but it's how much can we get by on, and like how much can we support? And in the end, we did manage to raise a lot of money for 648, and everyone was very pleased. But yeah, that's just something that is always in on the back burner at least.
I just want to say a final thank you to Lee and to Aliza for joining me on this episode today. It's been amazing. And another thank you to you, dear listener, for sticking around on this ride. This is the third of four episodes in the limited series. Next week, we're going to be talking about queerness, photography, drug use, and space making. So it's going to be a good one. Please tune in if you can. Remember to take care of yourself, take care of your community, and think about art critically. That's all for today. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
What a lovely Vancouver summer night. I can't wait to sit by myself at the beach and look at my phone. Huh? What's that?
Man, what are you doing? Get over here and come jam.
Wow, what a lovely assortment of musicians. What are you guys doing?
This is East Studio. We come together and build connections over music. No musical experience needed. Just come socialize and build your confidence playing music if that's your thing.
Wow, this is so awesome. Now I have a real-life connections with Vancouver's international community of musicians and creatives. Thank you, eStudio. eStudio is an international jam group where we celebrate music from all around the world and play together. Follow us on Instagram at eStudio.cafe. eastudio.cafe.
I'm not afraid to die.
Experience the world of education this Saturday, October 26th at the Vancouver Convention Center. You can meet with top universities, graduate schools, and professional schools from Canada and around the world. Register online to stay up to date and check in at the fair to be eligible for prizes, including a free flight to anywhere in the world on Air Canada. Explore your future with Study and Go Abroad this October 26th by registering now at studyandgoabroad.com/Vancouver/ studyandgoabroad.com/Vancouver/
Whoa, hold on. Where are you taking all those cacti?
I need to put them near the radio.
How come?
They love to hear Everly's nature-based music on Dead Succulent Haunt every Thursday at 5 p.m. on CITR 101.9.
Oh, Dead Succulent Haunt? Where your plants can grow and you can mourn those you've lost?
Come on, plants, let's grow.
Children played in the yard one by one. They threw a body from a window and the soul took flight. They broke fella's face, broke fella's arm, broke his heart with that sight. Mama, I'ma miss you. And your oceans of smiles, I will miss you. And the sun's in your eyes, Mama, I'ma miss you. Like the red mist played. Yeah, I will miss you until I see you again. Bob Marley awoke on the day that he left. He said, you know I got to go now, but still I feel so blessed. I spent a lot of days with my woman and with my sis, yes. With my six-string justice chanting down Babylon in the west. Oh yeah, I will miss you. And your oceans of smiles, I will miss you. And the sun's in your eyes, Mama, I'ma miss you. Like the red mist of plains, I will miss you until I see you again. Yeah, I've been traveling so very long. Yeah, trying to find some place that feels like home. You can't take away is the love that is found in our sweet destiny. Na na. Oh na na na. Yeah, I awoke the day grandmama had her stroke. And I cried and I cried until the tears stopped my throat. You see, she was the gardener and I was the soil. She said, boy, you got a long road full of love but full of toil. Oh yeah, I'ma miss you. And your oceans of smiles, I will miss you. And the sun's in your eyes.